Hello, I am Dr. Randall Brewer, and welcome to Health Matters here on listener-supported Red River Radio. According to the Centers for Disease Control, the perfect gift this Valentine's Day is the gift of heart health. Along with Valentine's Day, February marks American Heart Month, a great time to commit to a healthy lifestyle and make small changes that can lead to a lifetime of heart health. So tonight, as we discuss topics of heart health, please remember that Health Matters is a live weekly show here on Red River Radio where we invite you, our listeners, to join this discussion. You can call and ask a question or make a comment. The phone number here is 1-800-552-8502, or you can tweet a question at RRR Public Radio. Let's go ahead and meet our guest tonight.
I'm Dr. Trey Balcom. I'm a cardiologist with Advanced Cardiovascular Specialist.
And I'm Dr. Pavan Kattikaneni. I'm an interventional cardiology faculty at the LSU Medical School.
I'm Dr. Syed Mahmood. I'm one of the cardiovascular surgeons at Red River Cardiovascular Surgeons in Shreveport.
Okay, welcome to our panelists and guests, and welcome to you as well, our listening audience. The number here for your questions or comments, it's 1-800-552-8502. We have two cardiologists and a cardiovascular surgeon joining us tonight. Dr. Mahmood, I'd like to start with you. You know, tonight is the first night that we've had a cardiac surgeon here in the radio station to give, to give some of our listeners some insight into, you know, what it is that heart surgery brings to the level of care that this community can provide to our patients. And if you could just remind our listeners what it is to be a heart surgeon. Where did you start and what took you to become a heart surgeon?
Sure. Heart surgery is a way, so, you know, cardiology started, let's say, 40, 50 years ago. One of the first thing was angiograms, and we didn't have stents at that time, or angioplasty wasn't good. That's when heart surgery was utilized a lot more. Now it's getting more and more towards stents, but still we play a very vital role in what happens to people. What we do is we open somebody's chest and do bypasses. On average, you know, for certain diseases, our results are better, at least long term. Cardiovascular surgery, as in Shreveport, we as a surgery group, we provide almost anything you can get in Houston or Dallas. There are very few exceptions we wouldn't do, and the reason we don't do it is just because we don't have enough of a volume to get good at it. So
you went to medical school, and following medical school, you know, doctors match into certain residencies, and so what is that pathway in terms of becoming a cardiac surgeon?
Well, I'm an old timer now, I guess. I went to med school 15 years ago. It's much easier now. When I went to med school, you had to first do a general surgery, and usually you had to do a year of research, then and 3 years of cardiovascular surgery. So that's what I did. But now there's a six-year pathway right from med school. It's becoming much easier to do it.
And so the predominant amount of training is in the surgical field itself in terms of...
Yes, sir. Our field is evolved a lot. My basic training was mostly general surgery. Now the new residents spend almost 2 years in the cath lab, so they're a hybrid surgeon more than what I was. I had to learn a lot of things my last year of fellowship.
And from the standpoint of where cardiac surgery is today compared to, say, when the field originated, it seems like things are becoming more or less invasive over time. Is that a fair statement?
Oh, that's a very fair statement. Cardiac surgery is really thoracic surgery. It really started with TB in the 1920s, and then TB went away. Then, heart disease started. So we have been evolving for the last 100 years slowly. And now it's gotten to the point that, we're doing a lot more hybrid CABGs. Some vessels, if I can do a good open, I'll do. If not, then I'll ask my colleagues to do a hybrid approach and stent it. So some I do a better job. Some day my interventional colleagues do a better job. And we try to make a team heart approach for everything. A valve we do or coronary artery bypass, all is a discussion. It's a heart team now. It's just not me.
So there's a collaborative approach between the doctors that actually can perform endovascular procedures with a doctor such as yourself who can do the open procedures.
Absolutely, sir. And some territories or some lesions are best treated one way, some are only treated the other way, sir.
Very fascinating information, and we're going to come back to that. Dr. Katakaneni, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you for having me here. Pleasure.
So you're an interventional cardiologist, I understand. So from the standpoint of how you got to where you are today, how does a physician become an interventional cardiologist?
You will obviously have to go through medical school once you're done. If you choose cardiology as your calling, then you'll need a residency in internal medicine, which is 3 years. After that, you will have to pursue a fellowship in cardiovascular diseases, which is for 3 years. And at that point, if you wanted to further sub-specialize and want to be able to have the skill set to do the minimally invasive interventional procedures, either in the coronaries, which are the heart arteries, or structural work, then you will need advanced training in interventional cardiology, which is a fellowship which can range, depending on what you would want to learn and do, anywhere from 1 to 2 years. And if you wanted to subspecialize further and do more structural work, then you can add more to it. So it is a never-ending process. I think it is a continuum. I mean, we can keep on going doing our fellowships at that point, or learn on the go and keep educating ourselves. And I think that's how I look at it. But it does take in a lot of time and effort to get to where we are.
So basically the same amount of training in terms of length of time.
Yes.
As a cardiac surgeon.
Yeah, I think it adds up. The years add up, yes. I haven't done the exact math, but yes, it's a long time.
But you're really expected to be a general physician as well as a technician.
Absolutely.
So you have to be board certified in internal medicine first, yes, before you can be boarded in cardiology.
Absolutely.
And you said more structural work. Let's get back to that, you know, as we talk more about heart disease, because it seems like with the different procedures that have evolved over time that there are so many things that can be done, you know, non-invasively or minimally invasively now that it's quite fascinating. I can't wait for us to hear more about that as we discuss heart health tonight. This is listener-supported Red River Radio. I'm your host tonight for Health Matters. I'm Dr. Randall Brewer, and we are talking about the heart with two cardiologists and a cardiovascular surgeon. If you have a question about your heart or the heart in general, call us at 1-800-552-8502, or you can tweet a question at RRR Public Radio. Dr. Baucom, welcome to Health Matters. It's a pleasure to have you here, sir.
Thanks, Randy. Thanks for having me.
So from your standpoint, you practice out in the community. What's the most common situation that you see in terms of patients needing to actually come in and see a heart doctor? What do people out in the community need to be aware of that could lead them to suspect that maybe they might need to ask about seeing a heart doctor or cardiologist?
Well, of course, we see a lot of coronary artery disease, and sometimes it's more subtle than people realize. And so if they suddenly develop exercise intolerance, I guess can't do what they could a few weeks ago, shortness of breath, or of course if they get classic chest pain going into their neck, down their arm, they need to get in to see their doctor right away. We also treat a lot of congestive heart failure, people that get swelling and shortness of breath. And then as the population ages, we see more and more atrial fibrillation, where the heart goes out of rhythm and starts racing. So any of those things, shortness of breath, chest discomfort, or an irregular racing heart rate, those are the kind of things that ought to prompt you to go to the doctor.
And so that elephant on the chest, so to speak, that's a 911 level of needing to go to the doctor, correct?
That's correct, because about 400,000 people a year die of sudden cardiac arrest, where their heart just quits beating and starts fibrillating, and a lot of that occurs in the setting of a heart attack.
And what are the most common risk factors that you see in your practice and in our community in terms of folks being at risk for having coronary disease?
Well, these risk factors are the same everywhere, but we are down in the heart disease belt down here. And so diabetes, hypertension, elevated cholesterol, smoking, and then genetics. And of course, now you probably have to add lack of exercise. People in general get a lot less physical exercise than they used to get. And so that's contributing a lot.
So from the standpoint of the risk factors that can be modified, you mentioned exercise, you mentioned diet. And when we talk about, you know, exercise and diet, let's say folks who are doing those things, should they also be screened for, you know, risk factors for heart disease, like have their blood checked for certain lab values that could lead them to have an increased risk, even if they are looking at, you know, exercise on a regular basis or if they are paying attention to their diet?
Absolutely. Unfortunately, you can't get around your genes. And so even if you eat well and exercise, you can still have a genetic predisposition to have heart disease and or an elevated cholesterol. So at age 25, you should get your cholesterol checked, and then at least every 5 years after that.
All right. So all you 25-year-olds out there, you hear Dr. Balkum, need to get your cholesterol checked. Let's go ahead and talk to our first caller for the evening. We have Mike from Hallsville. Mike, thanks for calling Health Matters tonight.
Oh, yes, sir. I had a question. How much can psychological stress actually harm the heart?
Thank you for calling in, and that was a fantastic question. Actually, coming into this show, there was one thing that I was looking up to see what is the actual evidence out there to prove how much stress does damage to the heart. And I can tell you, we know that it does. Now, how much stress that you perceive could be a different amount that your friends might perceive. So it's a very subjective question. There is no straight answer out there. But one thing that is proven is that people who find themselves in stressful environments, either at work or in their personal life, and again, your perception is your reality. And I think that's what matters. If you feel stressed out all the time, there is a chance that your body and your heart ultimately reacts to it. And over the course of years, it starts to feel the effects for it. And I think that's how I would put it. So stress can never be a good thing. So that is why the all the organizations recommend people work, start a nice exercise program. And that is also in a way to get your stress levels down and also increase your metabolic fitness. And people do recommend other non-traditional things, you may call it, like yoga or, you know, anything. And if these lifestyle alterations don't help, then I think a behavioral counseling, and you need to talk to your physicians about if there is anything more that you need to decrease your stress. I think, but that's a very important question, and stress needs to be addressed.
Thank you.
You're welcome, Mike. Thank you so much for calling us. You know, Dr. Katakaneni, as a neurologist, in our training, it wasn't infrequent to actually see EKG changes when a patient had a brain hemorrhage, like a subarachnoid hemorrhage called neurogenic pulmonary edema, actually, and there would be this stone heart phenomenon where the heart actually, you know, locks up, if you will, when there's a really severe acute stress on the nervous system. But these, you know, you wonder about these minor stresses, this chronic you know, stress and endogenous catecholamine release and things along those lines actually causing chronic dysfunction in the way the heart works.
And I'm you mentioned that. That's a fantastic thing. And there's another thing where we call stress-induced heart failure or stress-induced cardiomyopathy. And fortunately, this is more of an acute insult resulting from stress, where we see this more commonly in women in the 40s or 50s age, who suffer an acute stressful event in life and their heart suddenly gives up and they go into congestive heart failure. And they do not have any evidence of any disease until that point. It is the stress that triggers certain biochemicals in your body that causes it, and it's an area of extensive research. Fortunately, once that stressful event is gone and the patient is treated with optimal medical therapy, the heart tends to recover completely in a few weeks. So yes, it is true and real that stress does cause significant heart problems.
You know, even in the recent news, you know, with there was a recent celebrity death, and then not soon thereafter the closely related family member died within a day or two of that event. And so there's definitely something there.
I think you're talking about Takotsubo.
Yes.
Yeah, the Takotsubo syndrome, which I've seen a few of them during my career. They'll come in with a massive myocardial infarction looking, tremendous damage to the heart. always after an emotional stress, a lot of times after the death of a loved one. I've seen it after a car accident. But the good news is it almost always gets better with beta blockers and time.
Yeah.
Let's go to our next caller. We have Paul from Lufkin. Paul, thank you for calling Health Matters tonight.
Well, thank you for taking my call. I have a diet-related question. I've heard from various sources that it really doesn't matter what kind of fat that you eat, as long as it's not affected by heat. The Eskimos used to be in very good health, and all they ate is blubber and raw meat. And what damages the fat? Whether it's a very saturated fat or a light vegetable fat is heat, and that creates various poisons in the fat called indoles and scatols. And those indoles and scatols are poisons that create bad cholesterol in the arteries. And I was just wondering if you wanted to add anything to that, because that's what I heard.
Fascinating. If I can plug the show for next week, Paul, we're going to have a dietitian on board, and we're going to talk about diets in some more detail. But I'm going to toss your question over to Dr. Baucom, since he did mention cholesterol as one of the main risk factors, for heart disease, and ask him if he has any comments about your observations regarding fats and the types of fats in the diet.
I do think they're onto something. There's because there's always been these paradoxes of diets, that people ate a high-fat diet. The French were always thrown out, they eat a very high-fat diet, and yet they have a very low natural incidence of heart disease. And so some of it is definitely these trans fats, fats that are turned into storage fats to increase their shelf life. They hydrogenate them, which makes them more activated, oxidizes them. Cooking also has the same effect on them. So I do think they're on to something. I wouldn't go to an all-blubber diet just yet, but I do think that the more natural the food you eat, the better, and a balanced diet. I mean, like I said, some fats, fish fats, are good for you. And so everything in moderation. And I once again put a plug in for exercise. Another thing about the French is they walk an average of 6 miles a day. And so they can have a little bit of pate at lunch and be okay. So everything in moderation. But I do think they're onto something about those activated trans fats.
Yeah, the more knowledge about fats would be good, huh?
Absolutely.
Yeah, and it seems like, replacing carbohydrates with just about anything is a trend now. Is that what you guys are hearing as well? Whether you're replacing these high carbohydrate diets with a little bit more protein or a little bit more fat, then you're getting better numbers. Is that what you guys are telling your patients to some extent?
Yeah, they go. These fads kind of come and go, but I do think they're onto something. Carbohydrates and sugar are basically the same thing, and so carbohydrate is just a little more complicated sugar. I do think that one of the things that's happened in the last 50 to 70 years in the United States is that the consumption of sugar has gone up so dramatically in these simple carbohydrates that might explain some of what's going on. And so I do think they're onto something. I think that we need to eat a lower carbohydrate diet, preferably replace it with protein and monounsaturated fats. I mean, like the olive oil, the Mediterranean type diet. But the carbohydrates and sugar, I definitely think is a problem, both with obesity and heart disease.
There's a question that has been tweeted, and I'll go ahead and give the telephone number again, 1-800-552-8502, or you can tweet at RRR Public Radio. And Dr. Katakaneni, the tweeted question was, what are the treatments for atrial fibrillation other than medication, and how much does a sedentary lifestyle affect atrial fibrillation and treatment plan? And before you answer, if you don't mind, just give us a one sentence definition of what atrial fibrillation is and what patients may actually experience if they have atrial fibrillation.
So to simplify this, the heart has two chambers up and two chambers down. The two chambers, in a sense, receive blood, and the bottom two chambers pump. That's a very simplification of the heart. So the atria are the chambers that sit on the top, and the upper chambers and the lower chambers have to beat in synchronicity, which means that they have to be having a nice concerted action for the heart to pump blood out effectively. And when they don't talk to each other electrically, you have a problem. So these are called arrhythmias, rhythm disturbances of the heart, which I think Dr. Bakum probably is a better expert than I am. Atrial fibrillation is one of the most common arrhythmias, or the rhythm disorders of the heart, where the upper chamber of the heart, instead of beating regularly, it just fibrillates. It doesn't contract or help the heart contract in a very concerted fashion. So the chamber doesn't effectively contract. As a result, blood just pools and hovers around in a chamber, stagnates in a sense, and enough blood doesn't get out of the heart as a result, and blood backs up into the lungs. So the patients start beginning to feel short of breath, fluid building up, and then this pooled blood tends to clot. So you're at more risk of clots forming in the heart, and those clots breaking away into pieces and going into your brain and causing stroke or to other parts of the body and cause problems. So that is what is atrial fibrillation, if that makes sense.
Good answer.
Absolutely. And so other than medical treatments, Dr. Bakum, could you elaborate on what treatments are available besides medications such as ablations and things along those lines?
This is a good example, too, of how things change with time. What we thought we knew about atrial fibrillation when I was in medical school and residency has completely changed. And now they realize that atrial fibrillation arises from the junction of the left atrium and the pulmonary veins as they return from the lungs. That transition between atrial tissue, which is active and electric, to non-atrial tissue in the veins causes a little border area that can be irritable. So almost all atrial fibrillation arises from those four border areas. And so what they found, well, originally the surgeons found that during heart surgery, they could go in and cut little areas. It was called the Mays procedure, and it would help prevent atrial fibrillation. And then we took that to a non-surgical technique called radiofrequency ablation, where we go up through the leg, isolate those veins electrically, and now they've added cryoablation. They have a freezing balloon that can do it. And they've really made great strides in that. The success rate of atrial fibrillation ablation has really gotten a lot better. There are several places in town that do it to great success. And then sometimes it comes back and you have to go in for a little touch-up. But those are the main things. It would be ablation of some 40, either radiofrequency or cryoablation. Or if you're getting surgery, heart surgery anyway, the surgeons can add a thing called a Mays procedure that will also decrease the incidence of atrial fibrillation.
Now, so if someone has a new diagnosis of atrial fibrillation, is the standard of care now to go and sort of isolate where that's coming from and go ahead and ablate it? Or is it still considered a medical condition and until medications fail, then the abnormal firing pattern is addressed from the procedural standpoint? What's the protocol now for that?
I tell my patients that atrial fibrillation is non-life-threatening, although it is serious because it can cause strokes, but it is relentless, so it's going to come back. But it might be 10 years, so you have an incidence of AFib. We'll always try a medication first, but some people almost instantly fail one or two medicines. If they're otherwise healthy, they should probably consider an ablation early on. The numbers now are very good for them. Their overall risk of an embolic, a stroke down the road, goes down dramatically after an ablation. On the other hand, if we try a medicine and they don't have another incidence for 10 years, then they probably shouldn't go for an ablation early on. So that's kind of how we gauge it. It's, like I said, you know it's going to come back. If it starts coming back every couple of weeks, you need an ablation. On the other hand, if on a well-tolerated medication, it's years between episodes, you might consider putting it off.
And Dr. Katakinen, what is the role of actually shocking the heart now in patients who present with atrial fibrillation? Is that a technique that is still employed on a regular basis?
Yes, in some instances. Now, that is not intended as a means to cure atrial fibrillation as the first line by any means. So Dr. Bakum pointed out the treatment is tailored to the needs of the patient, depending on how symptomatic they are, how long they've had atrial fibrillation, the underlying conditions, how responsive they were to the medication that is prescribed to them, and the recurrence and how disabling their symptoms are, basically. Now, once if somebody were to present with atrial fibrillation and the heart is racing beyond a tolerable limit and the person is collapsing or crashing, as we call, where blood pressure drops, you're dizzy, lightheaded, about to pass out, in those emergent situations, yes, the first thing you do is to stabilize the patient. So you just go ahead and shock them in an emergent way. Now, there are instances where patients are present with atrial fibrillation and medicine didn't help them. The heart is not racing away, but they're still in atrial fibrillation, and they would try to have a chance to kickstart or fire the start back into a regular rhythm. And in those circumstances, we do elective electrical cardioversions, we call them, where we sedate the patient and you try to shock the heart to see if that kickstarts the engine back into a regular rhythm. Sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. And at that point, you would have run out of options of medicines. You would have run out of options with cardioversion. And then, like Dr. Bauckham pointed out, then you start thinking about more invasive procedures like the ablations, where you try to go where this rhythm is originating and try to burn that. And then start thinking about more other surgical options like the Mays procedures and all, depending on the needs of the patient.
This is Health Matters on listener-supported Red River Radio. I'm Dr. Randall Brewer. I am your host tonight, and you can call with questions about heart health at 1-800-552-8502, or you can tweet a question at RRR Public Radio. We have three excellent guests with us tonight. We have Dr. Trey Bauckham with Advanced Cardiovascular Specialist here in Shreveport. We have Dr. Syed Mahmood with Red River Cardiovascular Surgeons, as well as Dr. Pavan Katakaneni, Assistant Professor of Interventional Cardiology and Medicine here at Louisiana State University School of Medicine in Shreveport. Again, the number for your questions, it is 1-800-552-8502. Dr. Mahmood, let's get back into surgery, if you will. You mentioned a number of advances that have taken place with regards to cardiac surgery over the past few decades. I understand a lot has moved forward with regards to treatment of valvular heart disease.
Yes, sir.
And if you will, explain to our listeners, you know, what some of the symptoms of valvular heart disease could be, the most common causes of that, and what some of the newer treatments are of valvular heart disease from your standpoint.
Sure. The heart has basically four different valves, and it's the more common diseases I see of are two different valves, and they pretty much present almost the same way. The most common symptom will either be shortness of breath. You can have a fainting episode is also common, or chest pain. Sometimes when you get chest pain, you don't know if it's coming from the vessels or the valves. 10 years ago or 15 years ago when I started training, there was only one way we could fix the valves that was going, cut somebody's chest open, put them on bypass, replace the valves. And sometimes in older patients, they didn't want it or they didn't survive it. So for the last 4 years, we've had this technology that we can go in for somebody's groin and try to fix the valve that way. It's called TAVR or transfemoral is the preferred approach, in which most people are actually awake when we do it. They're, you know, some of them are actually talking, and most people go home the second or the third day. And these are 90-year-olds, 80-year-olds that would have not done so well. The new and exciting thing for us, there's a lot of new devices coming in the mitral territory. Then we can make a difference too. And you know, I just want to add a plug for atrial fibrillation and surgery. That's another field. In the last 10 years, we've had a lot of progress. We've identified the lesions, and you know, we routinely resect the left atrial appendage, which we know decreases stroke rate. So, you know, just 2 days ago, the guidelines were published, and there's a clear mortality benefit if you try to, when I do my surgery for a valve or coronary artery bypass, if I can add the Mays procedure and do the left atrial appendage, most people will do better and live longer than what we used to do 5 years ago.
Dr. Mahmood, from the standpoint, if you were going to, let's say, for example, you're going to replace the aortic valve in an individual from the groin, how does that procedure take place? Walk us through that.
Sure. First of all, it only started we don't have long-term data on this valve. So we only do it in either intermediate risk, which means that the chance of dying from the procedure is less, is greater than 3%, or high risk. And intermediate just came a couple of months ago. But, you know, once two surgeons say no, because the gold standard is still open-heart surgery, we see me, two surgeons, and at least one or two cardiologists will see them in a combined clinic and then decide which way to go. And if we decide TAVR, they'll be set up for a CAT scan, which makes sure the vessels we're going to go through, the angles are right, and everything's right. Then we take them to the CAT lab. You know, we just put some local in there, in the groins, maybe make incision that's less than a centimeter, which is the width of your nail, and we can deploy the valve in 20-40 minutes. And they're usually eating in a couple of hours after and getting up after 4 hours. So it's come a long way over the last 5 years.
And from the standpoint of treating the other major valve in the heart, the mitral valve, are those procedures being developed as well that are non-invasive?
There are 22 different things in trial. There's something already approved for the mitral valve. It's called a MitraClip. We should have it online at in Shreveport, actually, in the next few months. We're trying our best to get it in. So honestly 22 different devices. Mitral is a little harder than TAVR. You know, in the aortic position, almost one solution is okay for all. But in the mitrals, depending on the size, the location, what the issue is, it's a little more complicated. But I from what I see in talking to colleagues, we're hoping the next 2 years we'll have a percutaneous mitral valve.
Very good information to know. Again, this is Health Matters on listener-supported Red River Radio. You can call and ask us a question about our topic tonight if you'd like. The number is 1-800-552-8502, or you can tweet a question at RRR Public Radio. Dr. Balcom, you and I were talking before the show started about, you know, how things have really evolved from the standpoint of stents. You know, how cardiologists began with angioplasty and then began with metal stents, but those stenosis would reoccur. And so there's been a lot of evolution in stents. What's the state of the art in terms of stent placement for coronary artery disease today?
Actually, probably still the state of the art is drug-eluting stents, these coated stents. And so they're not always stainless steel. Sometimes they're an amalgam of different metals, but they're coated with basically chemotherapy agents. And so chemotherapy agents inhibit tissue growth. The problem with bare metal stents, they worked initially great, but then scar tissue would form inside the stent 30 to 40% of the time. We'd have to go back in with balloons, and sometimes we actually went in with radiation therapy inside the coronary area. It's called brachytherapy. And then they invented these stents that are metal but are coated with these medications. And so once you put the stent in there, the tissue heals very slowly and almost never blocks the artery again. 96% of the time they stay open forever. However, they're much more vulnerable to clot formation initially because they heal so slowly. It's a foreign object sitting in the coronary artery for weeks or months before a layer of healing tissue covers it. And so those patients have to be on dual antiplatelet therapy. They have to be on two medications to keep their blood from clotting. We used to say for a year, that number keeps coming down with these new generations of stents. And the other thing, too, that has gotten better about stents is they've become smaller, have a lower profile, much easier to place in the coronaries. Actually, my career exactly parallels stents. I was with Gary Rubin when he put the first stent in a human at UAB. I took care of that patient. And those were big, bulky metal stents, like putting a nail in the coronary. Now they're flexible, tiny, low profile. And so when I'm talking to my patients about the options, I tell them, I was like, look, there's almost nothing we can't stent. But a lot of times it's not the right answer. That's when we refer them to the heart surgeons. It's not that we couldn't put a stent in. It's just that the surgeon's going to get a much more durable result in that particular kind of lesion. But the size of the stents, the profiles, these medications have all come a long way since the beginning of my career.
So from the standpoint of patients who ultimately will need heart surgery, that's not nearly as common as it was prior to these more flexible stents, so to speak, and more advances in technology.
Everything we did, angioplasty, initial stents, never decreased the number of bypasses being done in the United States. The only thing that finally had any impact on that were these lower profile drug eluting stents, because we really could treat multivessel disease with pretty good outcomes. Like Mahmoud said, there's some situations where still bypass is clearly better or long durable, but there are a lot of lesions we can treat now that we couldn't treat even 10 years ago.
And Dr. Katakaneni, I understand you're doing some research and perhaps what the next generation of revascularization could be for the heart. Tell us a little bit about that.
It's interesting. I'm sharing the evening here with Dr. Barkham, who put the stents the first time. It's glad to know that he did it at UAB. Now, you know, the field has exploded in so many areas. Now, the stent technology, like he pointed out, has really evolved. And as science evolves, more and more cool things will come in. Now we are at a generation where there are dissolvable stents that are coming out and that have come out just recently. And last year in October, the FDA, I think, approved it for use across the United States. This low-profile metallic stents that Dr. Barkham described are still the gold standard for comparing in terms of their outcomes and their efficacy. This revolutionary new technology, what it did is that it gave the patients an option that after a few years down the line, this metal that used to be a permanent implant in your heart arteries is no longer going to be permanent. The material will dissolve and then the heart artery heals and hopefully the blockage never recovers, and that's the hope. And it does its job. It's like a scaffold, like a bone cast I used to describe here. If you break a bone, then the doctor puts a cast around your leg. You don't need the cast for the rest of your life. You know, the bone heals and then the cast needs to come out so that the bone slowly gathers its strength and does its job. Similar analogy is in the heart artery. You know, we have a blockage that unfortunately develops, and we traditionally try to go up, blow up balloons and deploy the metallic stents. And the stent does do its job. It keeps the heart artery open, and slowly the body accepts it and then coats it with a layer of cells. But still it is foreign, and it's still inside you as a cast. So that led to the scientists in the field and develop stents made of material which will slowly be absorbed like sutures. Like they are gone after they're not needed. And the hope is that as technology evolves and that they will do as good a job as the current generation, the latest metal-coated, drug-coated stents do. So that's where the field is evolving, and it's good that in our community we do have that option available if needed. And again, it's not for everybody. It's not that everyone is a candidate for that or that they're suitable for all lesions and all kinds of blockages or vessels. So there's a lot of thought that goes into who might benefit from this. So that field has really revolutionized things, and I think it'll take off and holds a lot of promise.
So in the future, let's say you're talking to a patient and you have a choice between, you know, a bioengineered dissolvable stent or a more mechanical stent, for lack of a better term. Do you have any sort of sense as to what particular conditions you might lean towards, you know, the more, you know, bioengineered type of stent versus a stent that is the more traditional style right now from what you know?
So,
or is it still too early to tell?
No, I think we have already started using them in selective cases. We started offering them in October. So if someone is too high risk to undergo an open heart surgery, that their operative mortality is prohibitive, then they're referred to us for interventional procedures where we try to open them. Now, if a patient wishes to have an option for open heart surgery, maybe not today, but maybe 5 years down the lane, then those patients could ask us, could you not put in a metal and prohibit me from having an open heart surgery later, or make it difficult for me or the surgeon to bypass an area that has metal in it? If possible, that those are some of the questions that I've heard patients ask. And in some cases, the answer is yes, it does make a difference, and it is a reasonable thing to do. But there are some blockages which probably are in vessels which are too small for us to put these dissolvable stents. There is a certain size criteria that have to be met, and the blockages have to be treated and opened up well. There are some technical aspects that care has to be taken. Otherwise, these stents and scaffolds, as they're called, do run the risk of getting clotted up and cause more problems. So you have to be careful about offering this out to everybody. And I think good clinical discretion and procedural care should be taken for this.
Is it possible with this particular type of material, or perhaps materials in the future, in individuals who may have a genetic predisposition, have coronary disease early in life, and have an occluded artery, and they have much longer lifespan and don't want to necessarily sacrifice the lining of their arteries at in their mid-30s or mid-40s, and undergo something that would be more bio equivalent, if you will? Is that a potential use for these types of materials?
I think that's
well?
A very, very, very good thing that you brought up. When you have people who unfortunately are at risk for blockages, which keep on happening every few years, and they get a layer of stents to treat them, and unfortunately the disease recurs and the stenosis or the blockage happens again, and they have to have more procedures done, and some patients end up with several layers of stents sometimes, and you can only put so many stents in a small artery, which is a few millimeter in size. So as you can imagine, once you do two layers of stents, what more do you do if the disease recurs? There are some individuals who are very young and who have some bad genetic makeup that predisposes them to develop recurrent blockages. So it is in such cases where this opportunity or the availability of this technology opens up a whole new window of hope for them, where now maybe they can get a dissolvable scaffold if they have blockages which meet the criteria, and then hope that they do not have an event very soon. But if they do, maybe a few years down the lane, this stent is gone, so maybe they will have an option for another revascularization. It buys time, and I think that is critical in a young person's life, not to have options left for you this early in life. So I think it's one of the best patient categories where this becomes important to have this discussion.
And, of all of the risk factors that we've talked about, the genetic one is the one that we just can't really modify yet, hopefully.
That's right.
In the future. Dr. Balcom, we have a question that was tweeted to us, and we were talking about how educated our listeners are and how very good questions are typically answered. And so this listener is asking, do PACs or PVCs have to be treated, or is it okay not to treat them, such as with beta blockers, especially if someone who doesn't have high blood pressure but has these abnormalities on their EKG? For those of us who don't know what PACs or PVCs stand for, maybe start with that and then sort of get into the question, do these findings on an electrocardiogram need to be treated?
So PACs come from the two upper chambers of the heart we talked about earlier, the atria, which are thin-walled and don't really do much work. And so a contraction, an early electrical signal that comes from a cell in the upper chamber is called a PAC. A PVC, premature ventricular contraction, is where the same thing, but in the ventricles. Both PACs and PVCs are completely benign. One of the great phenomena of the heart is that every cell in the heart basically is capable of becoming the pacemaker of the heart. They all have that dormant clock in them that wants to become the pacemaker of the heart, and it backfires sometimes because they'll just start firing off. PACs and PVCs bother people. A lot of people have symptoms from it, or sometimes people don't feel them at all. We just notice them on EKG, but they're never dangerous. In people that are symptomatic from the PACs and PVCs, we try some non-medical stuff first. Increasing exercise will sometimes help suppress them. Anything that increases your parasympathetic tone will decrease the ectopy of your heart. That's the overall term for both PACs and PVCs, is ectopy. And anything that increases the sympathetic tone, lack of sleep, too much stimulation, too much stress, will increase them. So we try things like stress reduction, more exercise, but if they're still very symptomatic from them, only then do we recommend a beta blockers or calcium channel blockers. But no, they do not have to be treated if they're not bothering you.
All right. Great answer to a very, very good question, PACs and PVCs. Dr. Mahmood, You mentioned some of the non-invasive things that were going on in terms of valve disease. I understand there's some new treatments that may be available for some of the more catastrophic conditions that can occur when there's a massive blood clot to the heart or the lungs, called a pulmonary embolism. Tell us a little bit about what's moving forward in the treatment of that condition.
Sure. You know, having a clot in your legs is one of the more common causes of having a clot that goes from your legs to your heart. Just 4 or 5 years ago, you know, one of the only treatments available was to open somebody's chest and put them on bypass. But last few years, we have had a lot of data come out on something. We can actually go in just from your groin while you're awake and put this catheter in there, and releases this dissolving agent and vibrates and breaks it up. And there are a few other things that we can, you know, almost like a power hose in there, we can break stuff up. That's stuff that's really come along the last few years, and we actually offer it at Willis Knighton nowadays. So that's one of the new things that started just this year. The studies are showing that it's almost equal to cutting somebody's heart open, cutting somebody's chest open. That makes me very happy because the mortality sometimes in acute PE who are unstable is almost 40% or 50%. And if we can do it safer, easier for the patient, it's always better. So, I mean, my field is really going more and more towards minimally invasive, less invasive, as our catheter techniques get better and as we get more comfortable with using these things.
All right. We have time for maybe one or two more questions. The number for those questions is 1-800-552-8502, or you can tweet a question at RRR Public Radio. Dr. Baucom, you mentioned that the 25-year-old who needs to have their cholesterol checked. Let's just say, for example, that's an individual who had a father or an uncle who had a coronary event at an early age. Talk a little bit about how do we get that message of primary prevention out there in people who may have that at-risk gene, if you will, because it seems like every year, you know, I'm in that age group where this starts to happen. It seems like every year you hear of one or two or three people who have that, the first ever symptom of coronary disease is sudden cardiac death. I believe that might happen in maybe a third of cases. And so how do we impress upon individuals if they have that family history to get things checked out, and where would they start?
Well, most times when people have heart disease in their family, it's because they have genetically predisposed high cholesterol. There's a very high correlation between having hereditary hyperlipidemia, which is inherited high cholesterol, and heart disease. And so the best screening test is just checking that. It's called your fasting lipid profile. So without eating, that your doctor, any doctor, can draw lab work and give you a pretty good idea of where your cholesterol is. Is it, you know, low? Is it good? Is it a little bit high? Or is it dangerously high that needs to be put on treatment? The treatment for the last decade has been statins, and they work very well. They lower your cholesterol in almost everybody. Some people don't tolerate them, though. Now there's a couple of new medications that are injectables that work very well. They're expensive, unfortunately, but they're probably going to be the next big thing. So we keep coming up with new ways to treat your cholesterol. Rarely do people have a genetic predisposition to heart disease without high cholesterol, but that does happen, unfortunately, because the body is very complicated, and although your cholesterol level might not be elevated, you might have bad receptors for cholesterol, and that's what runs in your family. There's not as much we can do about that. Really, the only thing you can do then is lower your cholesterol and try to avoid any other risk factors. And actually, there are some people that have high cholesterol and a low risk of heart disease. And so if heart disease runs in your family, the most important thing to do would be to get your cholesterol checked and make sure you're addressing your other risk factors, meaning make sure your blood pressure is not elevated, don't smoke, and get at least a reasonable amount of exercise.
From the standpoint of the cholesterol levels, we mentioned getting that checked at the age of 25, and then if it's normal, when would you recommend that someone, you know, who is otherwise not symptomatic, have it monitored? How often would it need to be monitored?
So really, after 25, if it's normal and you don't have any significant other risk factors, you can wait another 5 years until you keep doing that every 5 years until you get to 40. After 40, you should probably have it checked as part of your annual screening, because as we age, for whatever reason, our liver starts to produce more cholesterol. And so there's no real reason for our body to do that we understand, but unfortunately it's a consequence of aging. So after 40, you should probably have it checked every year.
I have a question that just came in about alcohol and heart disease and heart prevention. The questioner is asking, I've heard alcohol is bad for cholesterol but good for heart attack prevention. What's the best or right amount of alcohol intake? Dr. Katakaneni, what's your stance on alcohol and heart disease?
One word, moderation. I think that's what it is, moderation, right? You overdo it, then you're not going to get the benefit on the heart, no matter who has done the study where, okay? You're going to have some consequences related to that. So anything in moderation is good. Now, how much is moderation? Again, a very subjective question. You know, a one glass a day, two glasses a day. The American College of Cardiology, American Heart Association, if you look at the guidelines, they made it quite clear. Women, no more than one drink a day.
Men. So that's one beer, one glass of wine, yeah. One shot of concentrated. Okay.
Absolutely. And men, no more than two drinks a day. And that is what is recommended as a public health measure. Now, which particular kind is good for you? Is red wine good, white wine, or, you know, hard liquor? There is some data out there that the Mediterranean diet that was alluded to by Dr. Bauckham earlier in the show has been studied more extensively than others and has been shown to be, in moderation, may have a beneficial effect, okay? But do you drink to cure heart disease? The answer is no. So are you harmed by drinking in moderation? The answer is no. There is some cardioprotective effect that studies have shown with moderation might confer some benefit. So use discretion and avoid excessive amounts of alcohol.
And from the standpoint of cholesterol management, does alcohol influence how successful drugs such as statins or the other medicines with cholesterol work? Will there be any effect on that? Someone who already has high cholesterol?
Yes, because if you are a chronic consumption dependent person on alcohol, the liver has to metabolize. So the liver can start showing signs of damage, and then the cholesterol metabolism can be deranged and your lipids can have an imbalance in your body, and that is a risk factor for predisposing you to more heart problems in the future. Now, cholesterol medicines, unfortunately, by themselves have to be metabolized by the liver in some cases, in most cases. So if the liver is not healthy and not doing its job of what it should do to deactivate or modify a drug, then the toxicity increases or the efficacy of the drug decreases. So the most important class of drugs that are useful for us to decrease incidence of heart disease is statins. And these are metabolized by the liver too. So it becomes very important for you to keep your liver healthy and do whatever it takes. And so as a class of drugs, there are several kinds of drugs that your physicians will prescribe so that your cholesterol and the lipid levels are in a normal range. And the most commonly used ones that you will hear are the statin group of drugs, several brands of them.
Another question that came through was about good cholesterol versus bad cholesterol. What's the best way to get good cholesterol up? Dr. Bauckham, is there a drug? Do we have drug treatments that can bring the bad guys in? Are there drug treatments that can bring the good guys more into the game, or are there techniques that can be used to bring the good cholesterol out?
Unfortunately, we really have not had very much luck in getting a medicine that will raise your HDL, your good cholesterol. Okay. It's very difficult to raise the HDL. Exercise may help a little bit. Some people think moderate alcohol helps, but really nothing consistently raises it. Fortunately, though, the important thing is the ratio. So HDL, good cholesterol, is like Pac-Man. It goes through the coronary arteries and actually absorbs cholesterol out of your arteries. It's like it just takes the foam cells back out of the arteries all through your body. LDL, the bad cholesterol, is laying cholesterol down inside your arteries. And so if you have a good ratio, the beneficial cholesterol, HDL, will go around and pick the cholesterol out of your arteries. And so it's all about the ratio. So most of the medications lower the LDL improving the ratio between LDL and HDL, but we have not had very good success at things that raise the HDL. And that's still true, isn't it? Yeah.
It is. And this is an evolving field, just like, you know, the technology instance evolved. There's more pharmacotherapeutical agents that are coming up now. There are individuals who have heart attacks and heart problems even when you check their cholesterol, and it may seemingly look normal. And there are individuals who have wacky cholesterol levels who never have an event. So there's a lot of genetic things that are going on that are being studied. Now, the LDL cholesterol, or the bad cholesterol as it is called, the statins are the first line of drugs that we have been using to decrease that. But if those fail and your levels of bad cholesterol are still high for whatever reason, and you are at risk of more cardiovascular events like heart attacks and you're having them, now there are certain new latest drugs that are available. These are, in a sense, actually antibodies, monoclonal antibodies that just came out and are now beyond the phase 3 trials and are available for clinical use. Two, three companies have come out and have rolled those. These have shown to significantly decrease your LDL cholesterol levels way more than any statin has ever achieved. Now, how does this translate into clinical practice? How much do they actually decrease the incidence of heart attacks or make you live longer? Those have to be been yet to see and studied. But there are drugs now, these are very expensive, as you can imagine, just like any other monoclonal antibody. But if there is a person with genetic predisposition and having all sorts of problems, there's some new arsenal to be used beyond the statin.
All right. Well, Dr. Baucom, I think we have time for maybe one more question, and this is going to be on early detection. And so what the questioner is asking is that, you know, they have risk factors for coronary disease. Their cholesterol numbers are relatively well controlled. They're still trying to develop a better plan for diet and weight loss. But what they're asking is, they don't have chest pain, but they're wondering, you know, should they have a stress test, or is there some way of diagnosing coronary artery disease when it is in a pre-symptomatic phase in a patient or an individual who has multiple risk factors?
Yeah, that's such a tough situation because, you know, screening tests, like any form of stress test, even a nuclear stress test, although they're fairly accurate, there's a significant portion of false positives. We say someone has heart disease when they don't, and false negatives. And so if you're completely asymptomatic, although we still screen some people at high risk when they reach age 40, for the general population, it's probably not a great idea. If you're addressing your risk factors and you still want to know, you can get a carotid ultrasound, not necessarily looking for blockage, but the carotid is a very good reflection of your overall vascular health, and it's easy to image. It's painless and virtually risk-free. If you're developing thickening of the intima of your carotids or plaque formation in your carotids, you're probably developing it everywhere, and then you do need more screening on your heart. And if that's still not a good enough answer for you, you can get a calcium score of your coronary arteries with a CAT scan. Pretty significant radiation dose with that, and it doesn't answer all the questions, but if you have a completely negative calcium score, that's a very good negative predictor that you are not at risk for heart disease. And so that's really kind of how I approach it with people. And
I concur. You have to individualize it based on the symptoms, the risk profile, and then take it from there. The risks and benefits of a non-invasive versus an invasive approach, and make a tailored decision for the patient.
Gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us this evening. As you know, Health Matters is a production of Red River Radio. The producer is Renee Moran, with production assistance tonight by Mr. Wally Derleth, Tim Snell, and Al Villarreal. Support for this program comes from the Noel Foundation, as well as the Community Foundation of North Louisiana. It also comes from a gift from Kit and Lisa Gamble. Join us next Thursday for Health Matters, and the topic will be diet and exercise in the new year.